Okay, so I'd like to thank my co-organizers for sneaking me back onto the schedule without me noticing until after the schedule had been printed. I'd originally given up my place for Bill Unruh, and I thought I was in the clear. But of course, I'm very happy to talk. So. So we've had this wonderful series of lectures by Yakir, both this week and also in the three preceding weeks. And you can watch all of them as often as you want on PIRSA, PIRSA.org. It's interesting to go back to how he started that series of lectures. So this is how he started. He said, at the beginning of the last century, there occurred two earth-shaking revolutions. Very soon, it developed that the fate of these two theories, quantum theory on the one hand, and relativity on the other hand, was very different. Any student who goes through a good course on relativity will feel that he has a good intuition about it. He can think about relativity from above the mathematics. It turns out, in the case of quantum mechanics, that this happy situation did not happen. So then Yakir spent many years developing this incredibly, what I've come to appreciate is a sort of coherent interpretation of quantum theory, telling a story about quantum theory that in some sense lives above the mathematics. But it might be that we were too fast. If we go back to the beginning of the last century. It's true, perhaps, that special relativity, you can develop intuitions that even though it's initially counterintuitive, you can very quickly come to understand what's happening. But I think for general relativity, the situation is quite different. General relativity is actually, I think, very mysterious. It has counterintuitive features, which I would argue make quantum theory look conceptually pedestrian. The two in particular are that it has dynamical causal structure. You know, the notion of before and after is something that is dynamically determined by the distribution of matter. And even more than that, it has this property of diffeomorphism invariance that I'll talk about a bit. A different way to put that, it turns out, is that the coefficient of friction between reality and the manifold is zero, and I'll explain what I mean by that. On the positive side, we've learned a tremendous amount in the field of quantum foundations by thinking about quantum theory in a conceptual way, I would say it's now time to apply those lessons that we've learned in quantum theory to general relativity, and then after that to the problem of quantum gravity. So if you're going to attack the problem of quantum gravity, it's worth spending some time thinking about which formulation of quantum theory you want to be the limiting case of your theory of quantum gravity. You know, the problem of quantum gravity is to find a new physical theory which, in the limiting case, goes to quantum theory on the one hand and to general relativity on the other hand. But there are many different ways of formulating quantum theory. And so the question is, which is the best kind of formulation for quantum theory that will be that limiting case? And I want to suggest that it's the operational formulation of quantum theory that we should adopt. So this is the formulation that's normally presented in terms of density matrices, super operators, positive operator valued measures. It's very well known and loved in the quantum information community because you can use it to prove theorems. It's not especially well known and even less loved in much of the rest of physics. Certainly, most people working on quantum gravity, particle physics, string theory, are not terribly aware of it. So I just quoted extensively from your first talk.
Sorry?
I just quoted extensively from your first talk, but...
Can you repeat it?
It does bear repeating. I just talked about how you said at the beginning of the last century there occurred two earth-shaking revolutions, relativity and quantum theory.
Yeah. Okay.
And that you said that the story for the two was very different. The fate, and I'm sort of suggesting we actually should go back and look at general relativity again, because actually it's not necessarily so intuitive as we might have thought, especially general relativity more than special.
I spoke to people that are quicker.
Ah, okay, good.
Although Feynman's quote was about general relativity, Feynman said the following, that after Eddington came back from his mission to see that life and events according to Einstein.
Yeah.
And he was interviewed by some newspaper people, and they asked him, is it true that all these three people understand general relativity? He said, who is the third one? Then the final was about that, he said, it's nonsense. Everybody can understand even general relativity. You just look at the equation, and you run it, and you can understand. But nobody will ever understand it. So every event said it.
About general.
Right, good.
Okay, so that's the quote. I want to suggest that GR is actually quite it's actually quite counterintuitive. So I'm going to talk about, first of all, about operational.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely, yeah.
Don't use the computer, or laptop?
Well, this is partly in your honor, because this is the last talk in a conference that dedicated to your methods, and I've never seen you use a computer.
Yeah, maybe in future conference we will say,
yeah, absolutely,
when
yeah.
I come, nobody's there.
Good, okay, great, good. So then it's just a few of us who were in keeping this time. Where is Ali? But also, I'm too lazy to actually, I started to prepare slides, but I gave up halfway. So I think I want to formulate general relativity in a way that's similar to operational quantum theory. And I'm not in this talk. I'm not going to get very far. Right? I'm almost finished a paper which is in excess of 200 pages on the subject, which nobody is ever going to read it, obviously. So there's no way I can cover any reasonable fraction of that material here. But I'm just going to try and give you a sort of hint of. Sorry?
You could with a computer.
Yeah, but then you won't understand what I'm saying anyway. I'll just be going too fast. So the idea is to do something similar for GR that has been done for operational quantum theory. So operational quantum theory is the theory that's normally formulated in terms of density matrices, super operators, positive operator valued measures. But I have a different formulation of it, which I call the operator tensor formulation. And let me show you how it looks. So imagine you have a circuit like this. Or any circuit. This is just an example, obviously. And it's built out of boxes, which I'll call operations. And this is really a diagram, a schematic drawing of what happens in the laboratory. Okay, so this is in the laboratory. We have various wires connecting the different boxes. These letters indicate the kind of system that we have. So A might represent an electron, for example, B, a photon. And each of these boxes has on it some settings, like some knob settings that you can adjust. And then also it has some lights that can flash. And when I write the symbol A, for example, I'm taking as implicit a particular knob setting and a particular outcome of the lights that can flash. Okay, so that's implicit in this symbol A. Between what? What connection? What was the other thing? Connection between.
You said that there is one, there is no, that we do. What that we say was A we do, and there is a flash that says what A is, right?
Yeah, what I saw, yeah.
And I think when you make connection, it depends what A is, to decide to make another.
Oh, right. Oh, you're asking if from these light flashes, I will have forward control to the setting on the next one. So I haven't put that in. I think that it just complicates the scheme. You could do that, and it would just add a sort of complication, which wouldn't be terribly interesting. So I decided not to put that into this. Okay. You know, you could always include it just by having wires that carry this classical information, but, okay. You know. So one question you can ask is, what is the probability that the lights will flash associated with with these operations? So associated with operation A, there's a certain light that can flash, like red, for example. Here a blue light, here a green light, here a red light. What is the joint probability that all of those lights will flash? Okay. If we can calculate this kind of thing, then we've essentially formulated quantum theory. Let me show you how the calculation looks in the operator tensor formulation of quantum theory. It looks like this. So far it looks the same as here. Except now I have to put hats on here. These are operators. So it's given by a diagram. This calculation is given by a diagram that has the same compositional form as the experiment it's a calculation for. But this is a calculation. I don't have time to tell you how you do this calculation, but it's worth saying that when you have a wire like this connecting two of these objects, these are operators, when you have a wire connecting two of them, then you're performing the partial trace over the appropriate part of the Hilbert space. So you can formulate quantum theory in these terms. There's deep connections between this approach and the approach of Yakir and collaborators, especially the multi-time formulation. So I don't have time to go into that. But there are some very deep connections between this approach and that approach. And indeed, when I proved some important theorems for this, I used the notation from that multi-time paper. One of the things that's interesting about this is that we don't need a background time. So actually, I gave a bad example. If I had given let me erase this one here. There are multiple different ways of foliating a circuit like this. You can think of this as if there was a background time and foliate it like this, or I could have foliated it like this. So I could have told a story in time in different ways. But actually, that foliation plays no role in the calculation. The calculation doesn't need the foliation. That's not true, incidentally, in the more standard operational quantum theory in terms of super operators and so on. I want to do something similar for GR. Let me just say, we have the basic element here is an operation, something like this. We have knob settings. And we have outcomes. And then we have inputs coming in and out. And so I need to formulate general relativity in a way that makes clear what each of these elements correspond to, what is the analog of these elements in the case of GR. And I have to do that in 15 minutes, which is impossible. Okay. But let me try to make some progress. Okay. So first of all, a solution in general relativity, you can write it down like this. I'm using my favorite symbol here, even though it's not normally used in general relativity in this fashion, because I'm trying to make it seem like a sort of a friendly home-like place. So what you do when you specify a solution in general relativity is for each point P on a manifold, you specify a whole bunch of tensor fields. And you do that for each point in the manifold. So these fields, phi, consist of the metric and then a whole bunch of matter fields. So that's how a solution is represented. But there's a problem with this. The equations, so this, for this to be a solution, has to satisfy a whole set of partial differential equations, the matter field equations and also the Einstein's equation. And those equations are invariant under diffeomorphisms, okay, under sort of general coordinate transformations. And what that means is that if this is a solution, then I can apply a diffeomorphism to it. So a diffeomorphism takes the point P and moves it to a point. It moves all the fields associated with the point P to the position Q. You can write this down like this. So the important thing here is that I've taken the fields and I've moved them along the manifold with some smooth function. So now I end up with this. And this is also a solution to the field equations because they're invariant under such diffeomorphisms. And it has the same physical content. There's an argument called the hole argument that sort of makes this thing very clear. So this and this have exactly the same physical content, although they look very different.
What is the diagram?
This is the manifold.
Huh?
The manifold.
Okay.
Yes, you have a manifold. At each point on the manifold, you specify some fields. And so the solution is that collection of specifications over the full four-dimensional manifold.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is not at a given time. This is over all of space and time. Okay. And then this is a diffeomorphism that can change it in any way you want. So on the manifold, if you have some coordinate system here, you might have things that look like straight lines, and over here they'll be curved. But these two things have exactly the same physical content. So in general relativity, people talk a lot about observables, but they're using the wrong word. So I'm going to replace that word with the word beables. And beables are functions of solutions that have the property that they're invariant under diffeomorphisms. So, if you can find a function on a solution that has the property that when you act on the solution with a diffeomorphism, you get the same value for that function, then that is a beable. These are the things that are taken to be ontologically real in general relativity. So one thing you can see from this is, imagine if I have some patch of manifold. Imagine I have a manifold. Draw that curly. So here's a manifold. And imagine I'm trying to say what is true here.
Okay.
What is true in this region of the manifold? You could try and write down a function of the fields that live in this region of the manifold. And then see if that's a beable of this kind. But we can see immediately that it cannot be a beable, because whatever function I write down, I can now hit this solution with a diffeomorphism, and it will take whatever fields were living here so that they end up over here instead, and it will replace the fields that were living here with different fields that come from somewhere else. And so clearly, the function that I defined on this patch of the manifold is now going to take a different value in general. So this is what I mean when I say the coefficient of friction between reality and the manifold is zero. There's no way you can stick reality onto the manifold. It's too slippery. On the other hand, look, here's a piece of chalk. Here's a glass. Here's me. There's lots of local objects just in this room. Okay, so there, that's sort of an immediate experiment we can do to prove that there is a useful notion of locality. Right. Right.
You discuss here the absolute thing, that for them is the relation between two things that are local,
right,
between Stainbridge and the main.
Right, absolutely, yeah, yeah, that's right. So that's yeah, but yeah, that's exactly what I'm going. Yeah, but okay. But I think at the back of our minds, I think we thought, you know, and something in special relativity, we thought, well, there's a coordinate system. You can talk about these points really existing. Einstein said that this argument removes the last vestiges of reality from the coordinates. There's no, they have no internal meaning by themselves. So this is a pretty standard story. I'm not saying anything that isn't standard. So one thing we can do is we can say, well, let's just form this object. You can see now why I put the tilde on top. Let's just take the collection of all diffeomorphisms and then form a set, and I'll call that object psi with the tilde removed. So the tilde kind of suggests that there's a manifold that you're using to represent the solution, but now we've just represented the full set of this. So suddenly now I can say my Biables are functions of psi, because the elements in this set have no particular order on them. So I can just say that this describes the real situation. The ontology in general relativity is described by this object. But if you stare at that object, it's kind of hard to see what it means. It's not a very intuitive object. So we need to find a way to make it more intuitive. We need to okay. So let's try and do that.
Why do you need a separate name, Biables? Couldn't you just use equivalence class under the diffeomorphism?
I want to use a physically meaningful name, Biables. Yeah. I'm a physicist, not a mathematician. Yeah. Okay. So we need a space in which, let's use this blackboard. We need a space in which things are local. And fortunately, it turns out that there's a good candidate in general relativity. So let's take a list. Of scalars. So these are scalars that we calculate from the set of fields. Remember, we have the set of fields at the top there of the metric and all the matter fields. So this is a list of tensors, but we can contract over indices and use covariant differentiation and all sorts of different things to get to scalars. So we construct those scalars from those fields. And now we have a list of scalars. And now let me plot this scalars on a graph. It's okay, I can only do 3, but it's going to be k. And now we can take the solution written in a certain, on a manifold like there, and for each point p on the manifold, we can plot the we can calculate the values of these scalars and plot a point. And if we do that for every point p, we'll end up getting some surface in here. The intrinsic dimension of this surface will be less than or equal to the dimension of the manifold. Okay. So this idea, not the application of this idea, but this idea is due to Westman and Sonego. The operational application of this idea is something that I'm trying to promote. What I want to say is that, let's see, so, okay, let me call this surface gamma. One thing that's important is that if you perform a diffeomorphism on the solution, so you go to the diffeomorphism version of the solution, and then you plot these scalars into here, you'll get the same surface. So this surface, gamma, is invariant under diffeomorphisms. So it does count as a Biable. But what I want to do is I want to promote this space and make it what I call the operational space. So you can imagine reasoning like this. Well, I'm a sort of, you know, a creature in the world. I have particular ways of looking at the world. There's some particular set of scalars that my observations correspond to. And I'm going to list that set of scalars. It could be quite big, although it probably isn't that big. Maybe 100, maybe only 10, I don't know. And then my observations are functions of point coincidences in the values of the scalars, i.e. they live in this space. So this is contingent, but that's okay because this is an operational approach. And there's various sort of ways of thinking about it. Like, for example, just the view from where I stand is really encoded in the values of electromagnetic fields, scalars calculated from electromagnetic fields that reached the back of my retina. Okay.
David would like to ask you a question. I just want to make sure I understand. Take a trivial case where all the S's are constant over the whole manifold.
Zero sig.
Then the surface would be a point.
That's absolutely yes. Yeah. And that's okay.
But what is it that guarantees that it's a? You mean it's a surface in the sense of being continuous?
Oh no, it needn't be very well. I think as long as these fields are, if the solution has the property that it's sufficiently smooth.
Right.
Well, sufficiently continuous, let's say. Then the surface will be continuous, and I'm going to assume at least that. But it could be, you're right, if it could be that the surface is less than four-dimensional, it could even just be a single point.
Right.
But that's okay, because if we lived in a universe where we had a single point, then we wouldn't be making any distinctions anyway. So that's okay. It fits in with the picture I'm trying, the story I'm trying to tell. Okay, so I've now got 3 minutes, including questions. Okay. Well, one thing you can do is inside here you can draw a box. Okay, in this operational space, and then you can look at where this box intersects the surface I'm talking about. So let me call the box A. This is a volume in this space, and where it intersects is gamma A. That's equal to A intersection gamma. Okay, so the picture is going to be that A kind of corresponds to the boxes I drew over here. This is a sort of region of the world as we observe it. And then gamma A is an outcome. So this is like the lights flashing. I haven't told you how you get knob settings yet, but that's a whole new story I won't have time to go into. And then a big part of the story is how do you now go about gluing these things together to make up a story about a bigger region from smaller regions, and that's analogous to wiring these things together. So these wires over here correspond to the surfaces on the boundaries between these boxes. There's a lot more to say, but I'll stop there. Thank you. I don't, but I have three ideas. Because you end up getting a formulation of general relativity here, which is very similar to this formulation of quantum theory. It has the same basic structure. So we need to see if we can sort of take some ideas over. And the best idea I have is that, you know, over here, these things hit the boundaries in sort of indefinite classical ways, but to replace those with Hilbert spaces, so basically to sort of quantize what's happening at the boundaries. And I have an idea about how to do that, but I don't know if it's right.
Yeah.
Right. No.
Mm-hmm. Alfred Dukir and Roger Penrose talk back and forth about general relativity. Mm-hmm. Roger Penrose thinks that basically, general relativity has got to subsume quantum mechanics.
Right.
Here, if I understood what he said correctly, and I'm not, he'll tell you, is quantum mechanics, general relativity has got to come out of quantum mechanics. It seems like you're going that they both have to come out of your theory. Is that
so? I think so. The problem with quantum gravity is to find a new theory, which could be as different from quantum theory and general relativity as, for example, Einstein's theory is different from Maxwell and classic Newton's theory of class of gravity. So we don't know for sure what it is, but at least there's a possibility it's open. It could be much more general. And my guess is that it will be. It will look quite different. I think I've heard Penrose say that you need to take an even-handed approach. The two less fundamental theories should contribute in an even-handed way to.
This is in 2009.
Okay. Well.
So
Yeah. suddenly I think there's lessons to be learned from both theories, and we shouldn't think of general relativity as being sort of basically the sort of the passive partner in this unification. I think it's as important. It's got sort of conceptual lessons to teach us, which are as important as those of quantum theory, at least as important.
Other question?
Yeah. I think that this idea is deeply connected to categorical theory.
Right, absolutely, yeah.
And I know that there are some mathematicians that wants to take categorical theory and wants to build the theory of everything.
Right. Okay, so I know very well the group in Oxford who've been looking at putting quantum theory into category theory in relative terms. They haven't those people, Bob Kirk and Samson Abramsky and so on, they haven't yet looked at general relativity as far as I'm aware. They have been looking at linguistics, but that's a different thing. This is clearly, these sort of pictures are very categorical in spirit. I'm not a card-carrying member of the categorical camp, but I'm very much inspired by what they say. Yeah.
Okay. You have this picture there, and I remember at the beginning of your talk you were saying that we have these gloves and lamps and whatever. If I will have probability for any outcomes of what I will do, I will have quantum mechanics.
Right.
Will it tell you what is the spectrum of hydrogen atom?
No, that's a good question. This is a good criticism, actually, of the operational approach to quantum theory in general. And also the reconstruction efforts that I've been involved in. I think what's happened is, in order to make progress of a certain sort, we had to throw out eigenvalues. We had to stop thinking of them as significant. So a measurement is regarded as a set of positive operators, not as being associated with an operator that has eigenvalues which have physical meaning. But I think it's time to bring that stuff back in, and this picture here, these things are physically meaningful. I said these are outcomes, but they're not just labeled 1, 2, 3, they're labeled by physically meaningful quantities, these scalars. So
yeah, it seems to be very meaningful, but when you start to see your measurement,
these things are physically meaningful. The general strategy is, people have been trying to unify general relativity and quantum theory for a long time. And the idea here is, you've got this very beautiful theory, general relativity, and this other theory has all these problems, quantum theory. And the natural thing to do would be to push quantum theory up and make it as beautiful as general relativity. And what I'm doing instead is bringing general relativity down and introducing measurement and so on into it, to make it, in some ways less attractive, but there's more chance of unifying these two theories at this level, and then perhaps after that we can go to some deeper picture. But it's a strategy. It's a methodology. It's not.
Okay. One last question.
Yeah, I'm just very curious here because you leave off at a point where you have so many possibilities, and I guess one of the reasons why people from gravity don't like it so much to have the operational approach is precisely you bring in measurement, and just so many possibilities. You cannot just talk about space-time itself, right? So how would you close this gap? What kind of measurements are possible, and what kind of relationally meaningful quantities are useful here?
So even more generally, if you're going to take an operational approach, there are sort of broadly two strategies open to you. One strategy is to allow yourself various instruments like clocks and rods and rays of light and test particles and so on, and then use those to sort of map the fields in some way. And that kind of strategy has been pursued by various people. Whereas the strategy I take is different. You take general relativity as it's given, as a theory in terms of fields, and then try to build instruments out of those fields. So here's a way you could build a clock. You can imagine building a primitive clock out of, any clock, if general relativity is the fundamental theory, then any clock ought to be describable in principle by GR. Of course, it would be very difficult to describe a sort of mechanical clock. But here's a clock that we can describe in quite a simple way. If we take two different fluids that are miscible, and initially set them up so that fluid one is in the center and fluid two is in a shell around it. So you have a drop of these two fluids, and then you let it go. And now, over time, these two fluids will mix. And indeed, if you choose scalars to correspond to the sort of densities of these two fluids, then you'll see this mixing in this operational space that I described. So this is a primitive way to describe a clock in these kinds of operations.
The mixing in this picture is the rate of mixing relative to the
standard flow. But the thing is that this thing would be well characterized. And then, of course, it wouldn't have a tick. It wouldn't tick back and forth, but it would be well characterized.
Yeah,
and you would.
The issue is what is the rate? It has order. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have observations that have order, mm-hmm. but the rate is important to try and correct.
Right.
The first I get one to the other.
Right, sure.
If
I mean,
you might do it very fast, I can do it very slowly.
Right.
There will be different flows, and you will not be able to be seen between them if you just look at this mixture by itself.
Right. So I mean, it's true that you would need to characterize this clock, and how you go about doing that is sort of similar to characterizing a candle that has this shape, you know?
Yeah,
you have to characterize it in some way, yeah. And I'm not sure how to solve that problem, yeah.
Right, let's thank you.